Very good. It looks like we have both counsel. We can see him, and I think we'll learn soon if we can continue to hear him. I'll ask the marshal to note we're in session and identify the panel, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Smith, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning. Welcome to Court of Appeals, June 4. We have three oral arguments, all conducted via Zoom, and then we have two non-oral that we will consider after that. Counsel should be able to see the clock in the corner. You're aware of that. Each party will have 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant, should you choose. We do ask that you identify yourself for the record. We are recording these proceedings as well as live streaming them. The recording will be available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours. And when you're not speaking, we do ask that you remain muted. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and begin. I'm sorry, first let me introduce the case. We have consolidated cases A23, 1238, and 1240. State of Minnesota is the respondent, Patrick Dean Nielsen, appellant. Now you may proceed, appellant. Thank you.
Thank you, may it please the court, counsel, attorney Jacob Burkholz representing Patrick Nielsen. This arises out of a consolidated jury trial where he's appealing his convictions, and I'll try and cut right to the heart of what I believe to be the issue is the admission of the forensic interview, and dovetailed with that is tied with the substantive challenge to the convictions. That being that the minor child victim did not make a statement that she was touched on any sexual part. So definitionally, we believe that the record is insufficient to sustain a conviction that he in fact touched the minor child in a intimate part definition by statute. So I think the record is maybe a touch confusing. Obviously, if you didn't litigate the trial case, there's two incidents. One's July 2020, one's November 2020. The July 2020 is the camper incident, and that is the attempt convictions. The November 2020 is the bedroom, which is, I believe, the actual touching convictions.
Mr. Burkholz, I just want to be clear. Yep. In terms of your sufficiency challenge, you're not challenging the sexual or aggressive intent element of the offenses, correct?
Right. I don't know if you can win that, but yeah.
And I'm having, in terms of your sufficiency challenge with respect to the camper incident in July of 2020, mm-hmm. How do we understand your sufficiency arguments when that's an attempt conviction, not an actual completed crime?
Right. I'm not waiving the argument. I think the state is suggesting I'm waiving the argument about intent in general. I'm not. I'm just saying that it's not easy. My client didn't testify, right? That's the real dilemma, I suppose, right? That Mr. Nielsen didn't come in and say it was all an accident. However, the record as it's stated from the child, I'm saying is insufficient. The child stated he thought I was mom, right? I think the state would agree that the inference was not that it was sexual. Now, again, if the court disagrees, so be it, but I'm not waiving that challenge. That if the argument is that this is an attempt and it's a sexual attempt, now I think the danger in this case, and perhaps I invited this danger by consolidating the trials, is that this idea that it must be sexual. And if it's therefore, if it's sexual in nature at some point, then it must be sexual at all points. But I believe that the child's statements are only the only evidence the court can consider, because there's no other witnesses, there's no circumstantial evidence, there's no photos, there's no other witnesses besides the forensic interview and then her testimony at trial. So what are we left with? The child saying, well, he thought I was mom. And so I don't believe that that's sufficient combined with no actual touching. So that is my challenge. So if the court sees this as an there isn't enough for sexual intent. I couldn't find any case law that says you can't, and there isn't a successful challenge, I guess is my admission to this court. I don't have a case that says this means it's not sufficient for intent. But I think the minor child's testimony in and of itself, combined with a lack of touching, there's no other circumstantial sexual nature. What I mean by that, there's no other things that I think the court can really point to or the state can point to, such as was there kissing, was there text messages, was there a relationship prior to or after that was sexual? And the answer would be no. So the record's really devoid. It just must be, well, it must be sexual then, if why else to touch him? And I think this is an affectionate situation. My client's there, they're in the camper, they're a family. He falls asleep. Had he been drinking too much? Who knows? But he touches a child thinking that it's his wife. Well, then is the inference by this court, well, if it's his wife, it must be sexual. I think the difference being sexual and aggressive is what the statute says, not simply loving in a sexual sense, right? We only have one word really in the English language for love, but that idea that, well, it just must be. But I think the child's testimony is insufficient. So did I make that clear enough in my appellate brief for the state? I know, Mr.
Yeah, I didn't see that in your brief, which is why I asked the clarifying question.
Thank you.
Do you, I mean, why wouldn't we consider that argument waived?
Well, I think because it's required under the statute for the court to review all the, we make a substantive challenge to the conviction, and because the evidence doesn't support it. But I guess I didn't make a couple of sentences on that line of reasoning. But I don't think that argument has been waived because it was argued at trial. It was raised on appeal, and the elements were challenged on appeal. So, but thank you for clarifying.
Mr. Burkholz, what role, the fact that they were consolidated for trial, what role does that play in terms of all the evidence and then how the jury gets to look at each individual instance, the one in July and one in November? It almost strikes me that it boils down to then a credibility is almost, this is what that happened. And you said your client didn't testify, so obviously they only heard from the victim, but doesn't that sound more akin to almost a credibility determination, which, as we know, the case law, when the victim is sufficient credibility evidence?
I think I understand where the question is going, Your Honor, which is, you know, if the credibility of the victim, if the victim had enough sufficient testimony to convict, then I suppose that would make sense. Then, well, the jury found her credible, and then therefore, but that's the problem we have here. Her trial testimony, credible or not, let's assume again that the jury found her credible, cannot convict. And this is, unless you make the leap, which they watched, the jury actually asked, I don't know if this is in the record clearly or not, but it probably is in the transcript. The jury came back and watched the video a second time, right? Not completely unusual, but at this point in time, they didn't have Mindy's to take back to watch, which I think they do now under the new rules, but they asked to come back to watch the forensic interview a second time. And so I think this is the compounding error, which is, well, we watched the forensic interview, and then, which I believe is inadmissible hearsay because of the inconsistency of the trial testimony. And I think the state appears to somewhat concede this idea that the trial testimony would be innocent compared to the forensic interview. And that's where the Bakken error comes in. And when that happens, this is where the credibility problem is really striking. The child's testimony under oath on all counts would be acquitted, except for the forensic interview. And the court did attempt to make a ruling that these are consistent. And I believe on appeal, they are very clearly not consistent statements. The child was not challenged. I know the state suggests that I challenge credibility. And I just simply said, listen to her statements. She will tell you that this is not a crime. That's not a challenge to her credibility, both in my opening and my closing and during all of my cross. In fact, it was just simply limited to, where did he touch you? And she says, and again, this is in a footnote to the state's brief, and looking back, I suppose it's a bit of a challenge to recreate it, but I think the court made its finding in its post-trial order, which is that yes, the child says when and recreates by her hand gestures that Mr. Nielsen did not touch her on the breasts. So it's very striking that she very clearly makes a very different statement. And I think, and again, it's hard to do this belt visually, but she makes a hand gesture in the forensic interview, like all over her chest. And she does not say that at trial. She says very clearly it did not go onto her breast. And I think the trial court, and this is why it would have to be reversed, because we're left with a non-criminal, or the court would have to guess, didn't touch the nipple area, didn't touch the areola, and the child says it didn't touch my breast, continues to say no to my questioning, and then in the forensic interview makes this gesture like, well, just generally to my boobs. Well, we have an 11-year-old who's making this statement. Well, what does that even mean? And so I think the forensic interview should not have come in the way it did, unchallenged, completely played, and it would be inadmissible hearsay. And what this court's left with, if it's an inadmissible hearsay, and that we have a Bakken problem, is that there's insufficient evidence to convict. And back to Judge Sleeter's problem or suggestion, what's the issue? Well, are we going to suggest that the victim was credible in an inconsistent statement, inadmissible inconsistent statement? Well, then we bootstrap that credibility. Well, she must have been credible in the forensic interview, which I don't think the state attempts to make this argument that it's just all harmless error. Well, if the entirety of the conviction comes in through inadmissible hearsay, I don't think that's harmless error by any means. The entirety of the conviction is, we're going to watch this interview twice. We're going to listen to her make these vague comments. And then there's a body picture, and there's leading questions with the forensic interviewer points to her vaginal area and circles it generally. More inconsistencies. When asked if she had been touched in her genital area, she says no. Clearly, clear as day, unchallenged, she says, nope, I didn't get touched down there.
Right. And that your client's only convicted of an attempt with respect to that camping incident where that part of the body was targeted, correct?
Right. And so this is an interesting dilemma. Well, what did the jury actually find or believe? Is it focusing on her testimony or mixing it in? But there's the dilemma we never get. Do we know how much they relied on the forensic interview versus her actual testimony? And so I think the error is too great by playing a forensic interview unchallenged in its entirety and allowing essentially the jury to begin to use that inadmissible hearsay. And I suppose the question I ask myself, and I'm not sure how the panel thinks about this, is, well, what should have been done? What would have been the proper procedure that should have occurred in this case? And this is where the state suggests that I somehow waive this argument. Well, I argued it was inadmissible. The entirety of the forensic interview was inadmissible in my pretrial filings and in the pretrial order and during the trial and at sidebar. And then the court in the middle of the trial orders me to basically take a break and says, well, you need to tell me exactly where it is. I mean, this is mid-trial, like mid-testimony. Go outside and then just orders me to make a more specific record. Well, that's certainly not a waiver. That's the district court inviting clarity. But in any event, you know, what are we left with in this case? And that is, I think the state should have attempted to impeach. If this is the argument, they can use a forensic interview and say, well, didn't you say? So the state would be crossing or even on direct. This is your video. This was your video statement. Let me play your video statement. Is this what you meant? Did you mean you were touching in the boobs, or he didn't touch you in the boobs? As an example of the type of a line of questioning for the child in her direct statement, instead of the child's done and off the stand, hours and hours have gone by. I don't even know if it was the second day of trial. And then we pop in a video and we sit back and the defense gets to do nothing. And that's how the evidence comes in. No questions, no commentary, no cross-examination. And I think when we're left with zero cross-examination ability, it strikes as an error, essentially the Sixth Amendment, and that when you have, again, inadmissible hearsay. So I think that the statements in this case, they're very inconsistent and elevates non-criminal behavior to criminal. And I understand Your Honor's suggestion, well, what about the attempt? When we're tying this in, if you look at the November incident and say, well, we are going to convict you of touching the boobs in November, well, then there must be inferring the too great of a situation to say, well, if we're inferring sexual or aggressive intent in November, then we're going back in time to July and then going to re-infer sexual or aggressive intent. Well, I think given that the glaring differences of the forensic interview compared to the trial testimony creates that problem of inviting a significant error or inf allowing the jury to speculate on intent. Yeah, I don't know how to completely reconcile any particular jury verdict of why they completely acquitted, but very clearly they believe that that didn't get touched sexually in July, but in it would suggest that the jury was also torn while they watch a forensic interview twice as to what are they relying on. And when they're relying on the video again and watching it twice, I don't think there's any question that a defendant should not be convicted on a video where there's no cross-examinability when her actual trial testimony acquits the defendant. And I think what the court tried to do is say, well, it's reasonably consistent. Isn't this just reasonably consistent? And I think what ends up happening is the state does in its brief, we focus on all the extraneous, unrelated, irrelevant consistencies. Like, of course, they're in the camper. Of course, the family's in the camper. Of course, they're sleeping in the camper. And other things happen before, during, and after. Those consistencies are irrelevant as part of the analysis. It is the actual behavior that makes criminality, such as the knife in Bakken. And that's the sexual touching that is inconsistent. And I think the court just focused on everything else as a consistency. So I'll.
Mr. Burkle? Oh, sorry, you just ran
Yeah, I'm
out.
out of time.
Oh.
Go ahead, Judge Smith, if you want to ask a question, then.
Well, I just wanted to add, so the district court found after your motion that during trial, defense counsel, I'm quoting, during trial, defense counsel in brackets, had the victim stand and demonstrate to the courtroom, including counsel, the court, and the jury where defendant touched her breast area. The victim demonstrated for the jury placing her hand below the areola area, but still on a lower portion of the breast area. So that would still be a touching of a breast, would it not? And what do we do with that? Why is that not a statement that the breast was touched or a t evidence testimony that it was?
That's an interesting statement. Of course, he's not a fact finder, but I was there. I mean, as an officer of the court, I was trial counsel, and the court is an inaccurate observer. I don't get to write an affidavit and say, that's not where she touched. I mean, she's wearing a big sweatshirt. And so if we're left with this idea that, and the court's not asking any questions to clarify, and neither does the state. So when the court says, well, I think it must be the breast area, she's holding her hand like this. And so for the record, I'm putting my hand flat below what I believe to be my chest, below the areola. But where do your breasts begin and end? I suppose on this the microcosm of skin in between your intercostal, vertebrae. And I don't know. She's not lifting up her shirt. She's not holding up a photo. And so we're left with this very difficult dilemma of where is it? Where is an 11-year-old becoming an anatomical scientist, wearing a sweatshirt to the jury? And I don't get to opine and say, take your shirt off and show it to us, because she was actually wearing a bra, right? And if she's wearing a bra, is it on the bra line? Is that underneath the breast? And that's, again, I think the challenge we have here is the jury is disregarding that testimony and going back to the forensic interview, which is inadmissible hearsay.
Very well. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this appeal. I want to start by disentangling the issues here, because that's critically important. The first issue appellant has raised is the sufficiency of the evidence to sustain the conviction. That issue must be analyzed, as the district court correctly held in its post-trial order on the defendant's motion for a new trial, based on all of the evidence that was received at trial, including the forensic interview. And in light of that fact, in light of the of counsel's admission that the forensic interview provides ample evidence for the jury to reach the verdict it did, the sufficiency of the evidence argument must fail on appeal. Appellant doesn't get to argue that the evidence is insufficient if you exclude some of the evidence. That's not how this analysis works. On appeal and on a post-trial motion, the court's decision about the sufficiency of the evidence has to be made on all of the evidence that was received at trial, even if the defendant disagrees with whether it should have been received. And for that reason, the evidence is amply sufficient here to support the convictions. Moreover, appellant has said a lot of things about intent, but what he hasn't done is pointed to places in his brief where he made arguments about the lack of sufficiency of the evidence for the intent. The law is axiomatic that the appellant is obligated to make arguments on each element of their claim and to point to legal authority and places in the record that support their claim. Appellant has now offered at oral argument mere assertions of error, but it's been well settled in Minnesota for nigh on a century that mere assertions of error are insufficient to carry the appellant's burden of demonstrating that there was error. He can't point any place in his brief where he made the arguments necessary to preserve his arguments about intent and about whether there was a substantial step, quite frankly, because they aren't there. Appellant has made no arguments about any of the necessary elements other than sexual contact. And as Judge Bjorkman's questions pointed out, with the attempt convictions, there's no question. The state wasn't obligated to prove that that sexual contact was accomplished. All we had to prove was that there was a substantial step towards sexual contact, and appellant has made no argument that the evidence is insufficient to prove that there was a substantial step or that there was the requisite intent. Those arguments are waived, or if not waived, at least forfeited, and they can't be remedied. You can't make new arguments for the first time at oral argument. That is abundantly clear from this court's jurisprudence. So I think the record is clear that the evidence received at trial is sufficient to sustain the convictions. I think the record is also abundantly clear that appellant has waived numerous substantial arguments regarding the sufficiency of the evidence by failing to make them in his brief.
Well, Mr. Smith, help me to understand sort of the penultimate issue, and that is, how are the statements included in the Corner House interview reasonably consistent with the child victim's trial testimony?
Sure. I think the district court, quite frankly, in its post-trial order does a good job of demonstrating how they're reasonably consistent. And the appellant tries to argue that the district court's recollection, quite frankly, findings about what the demonstrations were are inaccurate. But what appellant can't do is point to any evidence in the record that demonstrates that those demonstrations that the victim made were inaccurate. And so you have a jury who sees the demonstrations, who sees the demonstrations in the videos, who hears the testimony and hears the statements in the videos. And then you have a district court judge sitting through the entire proceedings, just as trial counsel was, and observing what's going on and paying attention and making careful rulings on the admissibility of evidence. And I think it's important to remember here, we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard of review. Appellant has to demonstrate the district court abused its discretion when sitting there at trial, hearing the testimony, seeing the gestures, seeing the video, seeing the gestures in the video, that it erred when it concluded that they were reasonably consistent. And as the district court points out, during the video, the victim uses her hand, positions it directly on the lower portion of her breast area below the areola. I believe that's an accurate characterization of the gestures in the video. And the court found that was consistent with her trial testimony, explains the gestures in its order. And again, it's the appellant who has the burden of demonstrating that this is an abuse of discretion. And the district court says that the victim demonstrated for the jury placing her hand below the areola, but still on the lower portion of her breast area. So when you combine the gestures with the testimony, yes, the testimony at trial wasn't as detailed as the forensic statements, but what the standard doesn't require is identical statements. It requires reasonable consistency, and it's fine for a prior consistent statement to add additional detail to clarify things. And this court has recognized that, especially with child victims. I've identified those cases in the record. And I think when you take all of that together, when you consider all of the evidence, including the demonstrations, which are part of the child's trial testimony, the district court didn't abuse its discretion when it concluded that these statements were reasonably consistent. I simply don't see how the appellant can meet his burden of demonstrating that there were that was so. I mean, the district court's findings are that the gestures in the video and the gestures at trial are nearly identical, quite frankly. And appellant wants to focus solely on the words, but that's not all that either the trial testimony or the statement were. And it's for the jury to decide based on the evidence it's seen whether what the victim has demonstrated and testified to constitutes sexual contact. The only question, if you're looking at a sufficiency of the evidence, is whether there was some evidence in the record that would allow the jury to reasonably conclude that sexual contact happened. And I think what we have here is a jury that carefully listened to the evidence, watched the video, listened to the video, watched the demonstrations, and made well-reasoned, cautious decisions. The fact that they came back and wanted to watch the video again suggests that they were carefully paying attention. And the fact that they acquitted the defendant of the completed offense for the July incident further demonstrates that they were carefully considering the evidence. Appellant disagrees.
Mr. Can I ask you a different part of that rule? What evidence or questions of trial counsel would you point us to that best support the district court's statement or finding in its ruling that credibility had been attacked?
Sure. I think that's abundantly clear. Appellant can try and characterize this any way he wants, but the reality of his statements are look at it's the opening statement. Appellant counsel said, by her own words and her statement, the victim doesn't know what's happening and that her statements are unclear. And then told the jury it would have to listen very closely to the words and to the facts of how those words may change when the stories are told today compared to when they were told when. I don't see how that is not an explicit challenge in the opening statement to the credibility of the witness. It's suggesting that the witness either doesn't remember accurately, isn't communicating accurately, or is changing her story about what happened. And trying to highlight discrepancies between prior statements and statement and testimony at trial is an invitation, is a challenge to the credibility of the victim. The district court was absolutely spot on when it concluded that the credibility of the victim was challenged from the get-go of this trial. How could it be anything other than that? The victim was the primary witness, and the case rises or falls on her credibility. And appellant recognized that and made those challenges from the get-go, from the outset, from page 10 and 11 of that's transcript 2.1. So I think that's I explained that numbering in my brief in a footnote. So I hope that's helpful. But I don't know why we need to look any further for a challenge to the credibility than those comments at the outset of the trial. And that was consistent throughout the trial. And the district court was absolutely correct when it concluded that there was a challenge to the credibility. I do briefly want to touch on harmless error. I think one of the most powerful reasons that the error was harmless is that the victim's mother also testified at trial. She testified that the victim told her that appellant had, quote, touched her boob during the November incident. That's trial transcript 2.3 at page 18. Appellant didn't object to that testimony. That testimony was received. As there's never been an objection to that testimony, and that testimony was substantive evidence. It was something the jury could consider in deciding whether the elements were met, and it renders anything that might have been in the forensic interview cumulative. And this court and the Supreme Court have recognized that even if evidence is improperly admitted, it's harmless when it's cumulative. State versus McDonald Richards, and then particularly I'd point to State v. Saldana, a non-precedential opinion of this court from last year, that cites McDonald Richards and concludes that the admission of a forensic interview was harmless because the record included cumulative evidence of the victim's statements to her parents. That's precisely what we have here. So given that fact, that there was other evidence unobjected to and admitted that the appellant did touch the victim's breast during the November incident, anything that might have been allegedly inconsistent in the forensic interview was cumulative evidence and was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The other thing that demonstrates, and I've hit on this before, that the evidence, the admission, any alleged erroneous admission was harmless is the fact that the jury found the defendant not guilty of the completed offenses for the July incident. So any alleged inconsistency between the victim's trial testimony and the forensic interview regarding the July incident about whether the appellant actually touched the victim's breast was resolved in the appellant's favor and couldn't possibly have prejudiced him. Given those facts, given the entire record here, given the district court's careful consideration of the issues, I think it's abundantly clear that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it admitted the forensic interview as a prior consistent statement. And again, the evidence, all of the evidence received at trial is more than sufficient to support the appellant's conviction. The state would accordingly ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel for appellant. You now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
One of the comments by the state that I'd take issue with would be the idea that, you know, we have to separate out gestures or the words or that one supports more strongly than the other. So the words themselves should acquit Mr. Nielsen and the gestures should acquit Mr. Nielsen. Now, keep in mind where the court's sitting and where this young lady is sitting hunched over in a chair, there's not a good viewpoint for the district court to make a finding on, well, this the district court just must be correct. So the state also, as far as I can tell, can't use post-trial orders to convict in a jury trial because the district court's not a fact finder. And so if the district court's not a fact finder, then what does the opinion of the district court matter other than to say that there's a very strong concern that the district court corroborates what I'm asserting is so supported in the record and the words. Again, maybe we have different interpretations, but I think in such a close case like this, where the minor victim is saying, putting her hands below her breast area, and keep in mind, she's wearing a bra and a sweatshirt at trial, and she, I think, wasn't wearing a bra at all at the time of these incidents, very different, and holding her hand below the area, and the district court corroborating it's below the area and doesn't touch the breast area. So why can there be a suggestion that, oh, well, that's close enough? And I think
here's the problem I have with your argument, Mr. Burkholz. I mean, somebody should have made a record, right, of the gesture in court. Nobody made a record of that. You're the party seeking to reverse. I mean, don't we have to just defer to how the jury saw that gesture and understood her testimony about where the contact was in November of 2020?
I'm saying the word that I believe the questions and the answers that I made are crystal clear that it didn't happen. I made the record by the questions and the answers. And so what I'm saying is that the gestures, that we're going the opposite direction, meaning the words don't suggest a touching, and then therefore the gestures acquit. The words acquit, and the gestures corroborate the acquittal, meaning there wasn't sexual touching, rather than the opposite, which is that somehow my questions and their answers of the victims suggest that there was touching. There wasn't. So I guess the way I created the record was very clear answers from the minor victim saying she wasn't sexually touched. So that's the way I saw it. And so the district court, I think, went the opposite direction, which is there to suggest, I want to find a conviction by suggesting, well, he must have been touched. And her hands just must have been on the breast area. That's the error. The error is the district court's going the opposite direction of the actual testimony and the answers. That's how I see it. And I think it's such the answer is saying no. And I guess if someone says no, and then, I mean, if we were in a rape case and the victim says I wasn't sexually assaulted, but then we would look to actions and suggest she was, would we actually be here really arguing that? And that's what happened in this case.
Mr. Burkholz, did you during, we know there was no statement for the record at the time she demonstrated, but did you indicate in closing argument, for instance, to the jury that members of the jury, you noticed that she demonstrated below the breast? Was there something that explicit that you did say during the closing argument?
Yes. Yep. I remember using my own hands, and I think I tried to actually verbally demonstrate my hands to the jury, both verbally and with my hands in the closing argument as well. So both my questions and answers and her gestures. And that's, again, I think the trial testimony really, I think, is undisputable that she makes it clear. Is it perfect? I don't know if it's ever perfect in the trial. What was I supposed to do? Take your shirt off? You know, I mean, I think I would be slapped by the district court, you know, emotionally by saying you're offending the victim here, by then going up on appeal and saying, Your Honor, I need to make a record. And maybe I need to learn from that as trial counsel by saying, well, I need to make this absolutely crystal clear, and maybe you need to pull the jury out of here and make a record. And when you're wearing a baggy sweatshirt to trial and she's hunching over and she says, no, I wasn't sexually touched. But again, that's my viewpoint of both trial counsel, her testimony, and my arguments I made to the jury. And then what are we left with? We go back to the inadmissible forensic interview, and then they go back and say, well, close enough. And I think she makes a gesture in the forensic interview, which is that this is this like big hand gesture all around her chest area, just kind of like my boobs. And then we're left with this very vague inference that we're now inferring guilt when her trial testimony was against it. So thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an order within the 90-day time period. You each have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.